Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We're going to end this hour with the conclusion of our interview with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who spent the better part of an hour with us last week in the lawyer's lounge just down the hall from court chambers, talking about her love of the law and the court she's served for more than 20 years. As a litigator, a judge, and a student of history, Ginsburg has always been sharp in her criticism of landmark decisions, a sharpness that belies her soft, whispery voice. For instance, she's a critic of the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. It would have been far better, she says, if a woman had been on the court back then, a perspective, she says, notably absent in 1973.
There was a later case called Casey in which Justice O'Connor did participate, and it's got a very different tone. It is centered on the woman, not on the doctor-patient relationship, and it isn't divided into trimesters. So I think, looking back from that decision, we can say, yes, Justice O'Connor had been on that court, maybe she would have influenced the way the decision was explained.
You have contributed to a completely different understanding of the 14th Amendment in your time on the court, and thinking of the Ledbetter decision and the problems that we're having in America today with income disparities and outsourcing and all kinds of issues in the workplace, does the logic of the Ledbetter decision in any sense apply to, say, undocumented workers who seem to be willing to work for lower pay, but there is a clear distinction between the wages of one class versus another class? Or is it just how the chips fall in the marketplace of America?
Undocumented aliens, unfortunately, are not protected by the law. And they are tremendously subject to exploitation. The result is that they will be willing to work for a wage that no person who is welcome in our shores would take. I think the answer to that problem is in Congress's lap. People who have been hardworking, taxpaying, those people ought to be given an opportunity to be on a track that leads toward citizenship. And if that happened, then they wouldn't be prey to the employers who say, we want you because we know that you work for a salary we could not lawfully pay anyone else. So I think it's different than Lily Ledbetter case. Lily wasn't willing to work for less than her male peers. She just didn't know she was being paid less.
Your dissent in Ledbetter led to the Congress acting to modify the law in a way that, in part, you suggested in your dissent. Some have described that your opinions are often an invitation for Congress to modify the law. Would you say that Justice Roberts' decision in the voting rights case is also an invitation to Congress to rethink preclearance, and that despite your disagreement with that decision, he's doing something similar?
He did it in Northwest Austin, a decision he cites often in the Shelby County voting rights. It was very easy to fix the law, to make clear that Title VII meant what Lily Ledbetter said it meant all along. That change, legislative change, was just informing the court, you got it wrong. This is what we meant originally, and it's what we mean today. It's quite different from the Voting Rights Act. The chief's opinion for the majority was that Congress got it wrong when it renewed the act and thinking that it could renew it without changing the coverage formula. Unlike the appeal in Ledbetter, it wasn't Congress that got it wrong, it was the court that got it wrong. And so Congress, please tell the court what you meant all along. They were different situation.
I have a 15-year-old daughter who works as a prosecutor and a judge at a youth court. And I asked her what question she would want me to ask you. And so, knowing that you might not be able to fully answer this question, I'm sure you'll find the issue to be interesting. Here's her question. Does she believe that the Second Amendment is extremely outdated due to advances in weaponry and increased accessibility of weapons? And to what extent does the right to bear arms protect anything at this point in time?
If your daughter would read the dissenting opinion in the Heller case, she would see that my view of the Second Amendment is one based on history. The Second Amendment has a preamble about the need for a militia. Because there is a need for a militia to be at the ready, therefore, the right to keep and bear arms must be secured. Historically, the new government had no money to pay for an army, so they relied on the state militias, and the states required men to have certain weapons, and they specified in the law what weapons these people had to keep in their home so that when they were called to do service as militiamen, they would have them. That was the entire purpose of the Second Amendment. But when we no longer need people to keep muskets in their home, then the Second Amendment has no function. So my answer would be, yes, the Second Amendment is outdated in the sense that its function has become obsolete. And in my view, if the court had properly interpreted the Second Amendment, the court would have said that amendment was very important when the nation was new. It gave a qualified right to keep and bear arms, but it was for one purpose only, and that was the purpose of having militiamen who were able to fight to preserve the nation.
Finally, your late husband was a chef, I understand. I'm the chef in my house. I often have thought, and this came up in some of my readings about you, I've often thought that if anything happened to me, would my wife get the right kind of food, get someone to cook for her? Assure me that if the chef were to leave, someone would take care of my wife.
I nominate your 15-year-old daughter. I have a daughter who is now 58. But when she was about your daughter's age, she noticed a big difference between daddy's cooking and mommy's cooking. Up until then, I was the everyday cook. Marty cooked on weekends and whenever we had company. So my daughter, who genuinely loves good food, made Marty. She gave him sole command of the kitchen. And so for all the years I've lived in D.C., and now it's over 30, I have never cooked a meal. When Marty died, Jane took it upon herself to come every month, spend one day with me, spend the whole day cooking, fill my freezer, and so I continue to be very well fed.
You hear that, Zoe? Justice Ginsburg, thank you so much for a delightful afternoon.
Thank you very much.
You can hear part one of our interview with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and read the full transcript at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.